At Vertex, we know the pace of global commerce is increasing, which makes managing tax more complex. And your enterprise systems weren't built to handle that tax complexity. This is where we come in, with our platform that enables continuous compliance, giving you more transparency, improved accuracy, and better confidence in your tax data. To learn more about continuous compliance, visit vertexinc.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Political Currency
with Ed Balls and George Osborne.
So here we are, back again, but this time I'm afraid we're remote and actually quite a few time zones apart. It's the afternoon for me. I think it's quite early in the morning for you, George.
Yes, I'm in San Francisco. I'm off this afternoon to teach a class at Stanford University, which I do every year, and I love doing. It's a kind of immersion into Silicon Valley, into what feels like a very different world. I've got a self-driving car park behind me out that window, doing quite a better job than most people do in a car park.
And presumably it's all sort of oat milk chai lattes and yoga. And are you basically living the West Coast dream?
Well, I've been to Barry's boot camp a couple of times in the financial district.
What is Barry's boot camp? I've no idea what that means.
It's basically 30 people, most of whom are much younger than me, running on treadmills and doing weights and being shouted at.
Did you get through the full 30 minutes?
It's an hour, I have, you know.
It's
great. I always find coming to the West Coast of America, it's just such a different experience from going to the East Coast and New York, which still has such a sort of connection to Europe and the UK. Whereas here, you do just feel, you feel in a very, very different place. And you also feel this is where the future's being forged on the technology front. It feels quite remote, actually, from what's going on in the world. Although, as we'll discuss on the show, real-world events are impinging here on the Stanford campus.
And I'm sure we'll come back to this later as well, but there's something about conservative chancellors, current and former, which means they're drawn to San Francisco. Jeremy Hunt was there a few weeks ago. I mean, Rishi Sunak?
No, Rishi Sunak is a graduate of the Graduate School of Business, which is where I teach my course, where I'm a lecturer. So he's one of their favoured sons. There's general incomprehension here why this Stanford graduate isn't doing much better in British politics.
We will discuss that in a moment. I, meanwhile, am in the rather less salubrious, but from my point of view, very home-like town of Castleford on the edge of Leeds in West Yorkshire, in Yvette's constituency. But also, I'm going to the second playoff match tonight, Leeds versus Norwich. We drew 0-0. And talking of football, we played our match last Friday. We were very much hoping that you would be able to make it, but I know work stopped you in the end. But this was the parliamentary all-stars, including Andy Burnham and Sadiq Khan and James Pennell, Jim Murphy, a few of us, and the parliamentary journalists. Unfortunately, we lost. It was either 4-1 or 5-1. I've forgotten. Although they were younger.
How do you let that happen?
Well, because they were quite a lot younger than us. And as I've been explaining to people, as in the economy, although it looks like we lost, age adjusted, we actually won 3-2. I had a shirt for you. So as you know, the parliamentary team was sponsored by the Political Currency podcast.
For people who can't see this, you're holding up a white shirt, a white football strip with Political Currency written right across it. I mean, it looks a bit like the Spurs strip, doesn't it?
Well, it was white. But anyway. because we had Tory and Labour players, I went for white. But we were all hoping you were going to come and do a John Terry a la Moscow Champions League. And I'd actually got you the number 11 shirt. There it is. You can see 11 on the back. Yeah. I've got loads of number 11 shirts given to me over the years, but unfortunately I can't wear them because I never got there. Whereas here it is in a number 11 shirt for you. So I'm going to bring...
I will definitely wear that.
But look, we've got to get on because it's all been kicking off here in Britain while you've been away.
Yeah, so we've got to talk about Keir Starmer unveiling those six pledges, the updated Labour pledge card, and what that tells us about the current state of the Labour Party and how it compares with the commitments that Rishi Sunak has already made.
Then we're going to talk about the Labour Shadow Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, who was out in America, like you and like David Cameron in the days before, preparing for government in David Lammy's case, but in particular meeting some senior people, not just from the Republican side, but people who are close to Donald Trump. Quite a big step for David Lammy. And we're going to talk about what that tells us about the Lammy approach to foreign policy.
Yes, I think he met a couple of people I do know, J.D. Vance and Lindsey Graham, two Republican senators who are friends of Trump. So that's an interesting visit. And while I'm here in the United States, it would be remiss not to talk about these incredible protests on the various university and college campuses around America, including Stanford. And I went to inspect the encampment of the pro-Palestinian protesters in Stanford the other day, so I can bring some live reporting to Political Currency. But let's start in the Thames estuary. Let's go to Thurrock, where earlier today, Keir Starmer and the whole Shadow Cabinet turned up and Starmer unveiled, shirt sleeves rolled up, very New Labour in style, the pledge cards, six pledges. Tell me a bit about the pledges.
Well, the pledges are to deliver economic stability, cut NHS waiting times, launch a new border security command, set up Great British Energy, crack down on antisocial behaviour and recruit 6,500 new teachers. And they are described as Keir Starmer's first steps, the things he's going to do immediately on the road to his more long-term missions that he set out. And I think we can hear him announcing this today.
This is a changed Labour Party with a plan to take us forward. And I have ambition for this country. And like all ambition, that starts with first steps. First steps towards higher growth, an NHS back on its feet, secure borders, cheaper bills, safer streets, and opportunities for your children.
They're quite general, these six pledges. Other than the one on teachers, which has actually got numbers in, to recruit 6,500 new teachers, most of the rest of them are harder to measure without kind of clear timescales. But I think what they are doing is, first of all, saying, if you wonder, will Labour make any difference, here's some things we're going to do. Secondly, they're saying it's all costed, it's all paid for, everything is fully funded. They're also saying this is not the Jeremy Corbyn manifesto of 2019, which had a huge spending bill attached to it. And as you said a moment ago, it's very 1997. I mean, the picture of Keir Starmer with his sleeves rolled up in a white shirt is very Tony Blair.
Yeah, I mean, I thought looking at that picture, you know, as you were just describing, I mean, that was an absolute kind of carbon copy of Tony Blair in 1997. Wasn't it? I mean, you know, the shadow cabinet all in suits behind, the leader in front with the shirt sleeves rolled up, the pledge card being held up. I mean, it was deja vu all over again.
And that pledge card in 1997 did work brilliantly well. And the interesting thing I realised as I was thinking about our conversation today, I could remember all of the five pledges. In 2015, we had similar pledges and I found it harder to recall what they were, even though I was the Shadow Chancellor. That was much more recent because they didn't have anywhere near the impact and the salience. And I think that's partly because, you know, in 2015, I mean, we were trying to achieve the same thing to show that our plan was fully costed and paid for. But Labour had been in government just a few years before. And in 97, this was a new start and the new things to be done. And that's, I think, what Keir Starmer is trying to achieve here, to kind of get that same galvanizing momentum.
Can I make this observation? See, I'd be interested to get your thoughts on it, which is, you know, it's very slick, the production. It's meaningful that it's in the Thames estuary. So that's kind of classic, you know, Mondeo man battleground, as they would have said back in the 1990s. But it was a throwback. The point about New Labour back in the 90s and the pledge cards and the ads, which were bright coloured ads with the pledges on them, was that it felt very fresh and modern and new. We hadn't seen anything quite like it in politics before. And we'd come out of a long period where Margaret Thatcher had defined the political age and then John Major. And John Major had stood on his soapbox. You know, he'd been the opposite of the kind of slick production. But the kind of Starmer launch just felt a bit old-fashioned, even if it was highly professional, even if it was deliberately aping Tony Blair. And I feel there's sort of hole in British politics, which is, where's the new way of doing things? Where's the new way of presenting things? Well, I guess we're going to come on and talk about Donald Trump. And of course, we've had in our country Boris Johnson. And they felt like the end of the kind of Clinton-Blair way of doing things. Whereas this felt like a return and not something original. Now, I'm not sure what that original thing should be. I haven't given it enough thought. I'm not active anymore day-to-day in politics. But that's what I felt. Unlike in 1997, it felt old, not new.
But I'm not sure that whether Keir Starmer will mind that. His worry, the thing he has to defend against, is the idea that his plan is uncosted, unfunded, reckless, that you can add up a tax bombshell a la 1992, that the Rishi Sunak charge, insecure with Labour, danger with Labour, because the sums don't add up, that they're not going to protect our borders, protect our way of life, that cuts through.
That's a speech he gave at the beginning of this week, Rishi Sunak, isn't it? We should tell people. He sort of said, you know, I'm Mr. Security.
He did. And I think what Keir Starmer is trying to do is do exactly what Tony Blair and Gordon Brown were trying to do in 1997, which is to say, no, our sums do add up, that we've got sensible, careful things which we can do, but it's paid for and it's not going to lead to a big unfunded bill. I think he is deliberately going back to that 97 moment. The truth is, there have been pledge cards in every election since from Labour, but they had nowhere near the same impact once Labour was in government. And as I said, 2015, the shadow of being in government hung over that election campaign. So it was, is what had happened was a bigger deal than what you were saying you would do in the future.
He didn't put it, at least he didn't chisel them into a big block of stone.
He didn't chisel them into a big block of stone, although, you know.
You disown all knowledge.
Don't rule it out.
I mean, I know you distance yourself from the headstone.
It would be fair to say
it's got nothing
to
do with you, even though you were Shadow Chancellor.
I mean, the manifesto had lots to do with me. Carving it into a piece of stone. I discovered that in real time. And I did at the time think, I'm not totally sure that's going to work. But, you know, Keir Starmer, the white shirt and the roll-up sleeves, I mean, that was absolutely channeling Blair. I think what he's thinking is not that people want Tony Blair back, but that they do want some stability and some sanity and things which are kind of clear and costed and straightforward. And they will know they'll get some criticism from people saying, is that it? I'm not sure they'll mind that.
I just thought, my point is, I completely agree with you. It's slick. It's designed to be reassuring. It's a world away from the Labour Party at the last general election in 2019, when Jeremy Corbyn was, for the second time, put forward by Labour. But it just feels a bit stale. And I'm not saying that there's anything better coming from anyone else in British politics at the moment, but you sort of feel there should be a new way of doing politics. Anyway, let's go on to the kind of specific, should we go on to the specific pledges? I always think the most interesting thing when you do these pledges, you and I have had to come up with these lists of, you know, and you always sort of say, well, do you make it four or five or six? And the problem with five is it sounds like it's sort of deliberately five. And so you sometimes come up with an odd number. Just it sounds like it's authentic.
Gordon always wanted more. Eight roads to work.
Right.
I mean, you know, the more the better.
And also you're always terrified that on some radio interview, someone's going to ask you, well, what are your six pledges? But I thought a good way to start the conversation is what's not on the pledge card. So I thought it was interesting. There's nothing on pensions or for pensioners. Labour did have a pledge on pensions back in 1997. There's also nothing on kind of jobs and workers' rights, is there? And of course, there's been a row this week about whether Labour's watering down its various promises to get rid of zero-hour contracts and the like. So those were just a couple of things. I mean, there's nothing on defence. Maybe that shouldn't make a pledge card, but it's quite a dangerous world. It's interesting that that doesn't feature as well. So I always think of politics, you know, start by what's not on the pledge card. And I don't know, do you think any of those are surprising admissions?
Well, of course, back in 1997, as Labour's been saying today, the national minimum wage wasn't on the pledge card. There's no commitment here to getting to net zero by 2030. The mission commitment to have the fastest growth rate in the G7 by the end of the parliament is also not in these pledges. What they clearly want is immediate retail things. Are these going to, in the end, replace the missions, or do they... are they portrayed as steps towards the missions?
So we should explain that Keir Starmer last year unveiled five missions, which had sort of longer term goals, didn't he? So he's got five missions. There are six pledges or first steps today. It's a little bit muddled, isn't it?
It is. And the missions were detailed, long and not really communicable. I mean, I think they were much more about saying to Whitehall, this is our five-year plan. I think these are much more about kind of the things to talk to campaigners about.
I had a Conservative minister, tell me a story the other day that they'd received a submission with some ideas for what they might do in their department. And it started talking about these missions in the submission. And the minister said, well, hold on, calls the civil servant in and says, hold on, what's all this stuff about missions? That's Keir Starmer's language. And the civil servants were like absolutely ashen. And they'd basically been caught out because the department had secretly been doing work on Labour's missions. And this had seeped its way into the subs going to current ministers. So the language of missions is very much Labour's language. And Whitehall is already putting some flesh on the bones.
I think that the challenge with the public will be, compared to the scale of the challenge that it feels people are facing at the moment. And of course, back in 97, the economy was growing, people's wages were rising in real terms, people were feeling better off. That isn't how things are at the moment. When you think of the millions of people who are waiting on NHS waiting times, saying 40,000 more appointments each week doesn't feel very big compared to the scale of the challenge. You know, the border security command to stop the gangs, well, people think, well, okay, but how? So, I mean, I think there will be a frustration amongst the public that they want more. And is it, you know, is this really it? But I think if you are in opposition, you can absorb that, because what you're really doing is showing kind of direction and instinct. And as I said, the bigger thing that they're wanting to show here is that there's nothing unfunded and not paid for.
Yeah, I thought another interesting observation about these six pledges is there are quite a lot of inputs rather than outputs. So if you look back at the original Blair-Brown pledges in the 1990s, they're things like smaller class sizes. Whereas here we've got more teachers, so there's more inputs into the system. It apes, actually, the, in my view, rather foolish promises the Tories made in 2019 to just build hospitals or have more police officers without saying anything about reforming health or improving law and order. It was a sort of, you know, cut to some very sort of simple inputs, as if just having more hospitals is by itself a per se the solution to our health problems. And I think Labour are sort of falling into the inputs trap.
But there is a big difference from 97 or 2015, or actually any election in the last few decades, which is that Labour's putting pledges down for what it will do in the next parliament. And that's going to be contrasted with the Rishi Sunak pledges, which he has set out in the last year. I don't remember a prime minister doing this from government in a very specific way, what he's going to do on inflation or on stopping the boats or on NHS waiting times. And it may be that what Labour thinks is that it can contrast cautious, sensible, deliverable, paid for, quite modest pledges, and contrast that with the government seeming not to be on track to meet the pledges, which are much more big and ambitious, as you'd expect from a government. Maybe that is the strategy.
I thought there was a very interesting Today programme interview this morning by Pat McFadden, which I didn't listen to at the time because it was 3 a.m. or whatever, but I did, or earlier, even maybe midnight here in California. But One of my smartest observers on British politics told me that I should listen to this. And he's asked about Natalie Elphick's defection. And perhaps we should just touch on this because we mentioned it last week. It was sort of hot off the press when we were doing our podcast. And ever since then, there have been loads of questions about whether Labour should have accepted Natalie Elphick and was she right to lobby on behalf of her husband and so on. But the questioner, Amol Rajan, asks Pat McFadden, who's Labour's campaign supremo, well, hold on, it's a bit unfair because you haven't let Diane Abbott back into the Labour Party after months and months of investigation, something we've talked about on this programme, but you just let Natalie Elphick in. And I thought Pat McFadden's answer was very New Labour, absolutely ruthless and focused on what Starmer and his team are now trying to achieve in the next few months. Let's listen to Pat McFadden's answer.
We will not win the next election just by appealing to the people who always voted Labour. The only way you're going to win the next election is by appealing to people who haven't traditionally voted for you and who voted Conservative in many cases in recent elections. That is what the difference between losing and winning is. And there's nothing to be ashamed of in that.
I thought that was, well, bang on the money. That's my school of politics, which is you do what it takes to win. It's the best answer to why has Natalie Elphick been welcomed into the Labour Parliamentary Party and Diane Abbott been kept out. Why? Because Labour wants to win. And Labour wants to win over people who voted Conservative in 2019. And if it doesn't do that, if it doesn't win over people who voted for Boris Johnson, it's not going to be in office.
Well, there's quite a lot of hand-wringing from some Labour voices on this Natalie Elphick thing. But as I said when we first reacted, I think Keir Starmer will think the MP for Dover disowning Conservative immigration policy and saying Labour is better is exactly what you want to hear in order to persuade some of those switches from the Conservatives who voted Conservative last time round to come over. It was very tight, the handling of the Natalie Elphick stuff. And I think they got the PR of it wrong in the early hours. She was allowed to be portrayed as this extreme right winger. I think it was more complicated than that. And it was partly, I think, because the media people on the Labour side weren't in the loop until minutes before it actually happened. But fundamentally, is there any opposition leader or prime minister in the last decades who, when offered the opportunity to have a prominent person from the other side come and join you on the grounds that you're right and they're wrong, that they'd say no to that? I mean, no way.
I can't think of any sensible party leader who would turn down that opportunity. And it's interesting, Lord Ashcroft does this, Michael Ashcroft pays for all this polling, and he's just released one of his big polls after the local elections. And the Natalie Elphick defection is one of the most noticed things by the British public. By the way, the polling also shows Labour way ahead on economic competence, who can deliver economic stability, and Starmer and Reeves quite a distance ahead of Sunak and Hunt. So just a reminder of the uphill task that the Tories face. Although I thought Sunak had quite a good response at Prime Minister's questions. It was actually one of his, you know, better riposts to Starmer. You know, when Starmer was trying to make fun of this row in the Tory cabinet about whether civil servants can wear these lanyards that say they support particular political causes. And he said he wasn't essentially going to get any lessons on civil service impartiality from a Labour leader who had hired Sue Gray, the former civil servant. So it was, you know, Sunak's shown some fight. The speech at the beginning of the week was a good speech that he did at Policy Exchange, kind of defining the election partly in security terms.
It was kind of, yeah, but the thing is, George, he made five pledges. He said, judge me by these. His problem is he's not on track to meet them. So now he's tried to have another relaunch with a new thing, which is about security, and a new pledge, which is about defence spending. And it's sort of continually trying to find something else which might work. Do you think these pledges are going to do him any good at all between now and election?
Well, I think he's really hung on this stop the boats pledge, isn't he? And potentially on the NHS waiting list pledge. He has halved inflation, to be fair to him. And actually, as we might discuss later, there's some better inflation news out of the US, which will help as a kind of prevailing tailwind for the UK economy. He did make one pledge today, which I'm absolutely sure he will end up breaking. Should we hear what it was? He appeared on Loose Women. Here's what he said.
If you lose the election, will you stand down as an MP?
No, gosh, I'm very much focused. I mean, I love being an
yes
MP.
Yes or no, no?
No, yes, of course I'm staying. I love being an
You're
MP.
Staying.
I love my constituents. I love my home in North Yorkshire. It's wonderful.
Well,
and I love being able to get back
in.
There. And
it's a fabulous question because there is no answer that he can give other than the one he gave. And when he said it, you immediately think there is absolutely no way.
He's also got a home in Santa Monica as well as North Yorkshire, which is not too far from where I am at the moment. And one of the interesting things, having spent a few days here in San Francisco and Silicon Valley, is that lots of people here know him because he was a graduate from Stanford. You know, he's very involved in technology out here and has worked here. And I would suspect he's much more likely to be back in Silicon Valley rather than in Wensleydale or Arkengarthdale if he loses the general election. Two of the valleys in his own constituency at the moment.
Well, we should turn to America now because you're out there. And I guess just to end this section, the one thing, if you're Rishi Sunak, that you are hoping for this year is for growth to strengthen the economy, inflation coming down, people to start feeling better off, and for that to translate into a bit of an uptick in your political standing. And his kind of worry when he looks across the Atlantic to America is that America, the US, avoided a recession, carried on with strong growth. Inflation's coming down, came down this week. People are expecting interest rates to come down in America at some point this year. But economic confidence has gone up a lot in the US over the last year or two. And yet, that is not translating into an improved polling position for Joe Biden. Joe Biden still doesn't seem to be getting the credit for what has actually been a pretty storming performance from the American economy and from the Federal Reserve. It's still the case that Donald Trump is ahead in all of his swing states and just ahead in the national polling. So if Biden's getting no benefit from a strong economy, that will worry Rishi Sunak.
And we're going to turn to America next.
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.
Welcome back. Well, here in the United States, the news is completely dominated, not by the better inflation numbers, which is what Joe Biden wants to talk about, or the jobs numbers, which is at the heart of the Biden re-election campaign, but Donald Trump's trial in New York. And under any normal laws of politics that would have operated in your or my time, Ed, you would assume that having someone on trial for paying hush money to a porn star and that porn star taking the witness stand, you know, would totally destroy the credibility of that person. And there would be no chance that that person could ever be a candidate for anything, let alone President of the United States. And yet the trial is seeming to make it even more likely that Donald Trump is going to be the president, because it has generated enormous attention for him. It's made him look like the underdog and the outsider again, and unfairly kind of treated by the system. And you've had this extraordinary spectacle, I've been watching it on the television here, of every single day at the trial in the courthouse, a string of senior Republicans, including the Speaker of the House of Representatives, various governors from American states, senators, turn up and sit in the kind of public gallery in support of Donald Trump, wearing red ties to show that they are supporting Donald, who always wears a red tie. It's absolutely staggering.
But that is not the only surprising spectacle. We've also seen, and Tim Shipman captured this really well at the weekend in the Sunday Times, both the Foreign Secretary, David Cameron, and the Shadow Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, both trying to persuade us all that they are the person with the contact book and the reach and the leverage to influence, potentially, the Trump presidency. David Cameron saying that he can persuade Trump how he could turn the Ukraine issue to his advantage. David Lammy's meeting a series of senior Trump supporters, including J.D. Vance and Lindsey Graham, to say, you know, I can work with Donald Trump. And that's also been surprising to watch.
Yes. I mean, David told me some of what happened at the Trump dinner. He says basically Trump has a speakerphone like on the table. And just throughout dinner, people are calling senators, congressmen, journalists, whatever. And he just like throughout dinner, he just puts them on speakerphone and says, hi, I got Cameron here. And that's the way the dinner proceeds. But, you know, I think to be fair to David and the efforts of lots of people, including key figures in the Labour Party, the West did succeed. The Europeans, Brits, everyone did succeed in getting the Republicans to commit to an aid package for Ukraine. So I would say that's sort of mission accomplished. Meanwhile, David Lammy, by travelling to Washington and getting closer to the Republican Party, is doing exactly what anyone who's shadow foreign secretary but expects to be in the Foreign Office later this year should be doing. I know J.D. Vance and Lindsey Graham both pretty well, and they're both kind of colourful, interesting characters who've ended up going from being anti-Trump people. I remember being in San Francisco on the day of the presidential election in 2016 and having a coffee with J.D. Vance. This is the guy who wrote that famous book, Hillbilly Elegy, about his upbringing in the Appalachians, and it was turned into a movie. And I remember having coffee with him, and he was just really wondering whether he could possibly vote for Trump. And now he's one of the most ardent Trump supporters and could potentially be his vice president. And Lindsey Graham, you know, is this wonderful senator from the Carolinas who came to various Conservative Party conferences to support us and used to have phrases like, where I come from, they believe in Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. And so he's a kind of cultural conservative, been a big figure in the Republican Party. So Lammy is meeting the right people, although he hasn't actually met Trump himself. And it's quite a journey, isn't it, from when he used to say this about Donald Trump.
A president who's said awful things during London's lowest moments of terrorism, who was attacked, our democratically elected mayor, Sadiq Khan, a president who has retweeted far-right hatred of Britain First, the hatred that saw the death of Joe Cox. For all of those reasons and so much more, people are coming out in droves today to make it absolutely clear that Donald Trump is not welcome in our country.
I don't know whether your speculation over the last month or so about whether David Cameron might stay on and be the foreign secretary in the Keir Starmer government has been in any way galvanising. I think probably not, because I don't think Keir Starmer's going to do that. But David Lammy has had, you know, quite a media blitz over the last couple of weeks, as you've said, not just those meetings, but also big interview in the Times last Saturday. I think he's been doing really well, setting the agenda, his speech, his article in Foreign Affairs about his approach to foreign policy. He's calling it progressive realism. He's out there saying, you know, I can meet the Trump guys. I've got the contact book. I'm not going to be pushed aside by David Cameron. So although I'm not sure that's what's going on, if it is what's going on, he's been doing it quite successfully. But there is a deeper thing, isn't there, with David Lammy, because there was some reputation to turn around from his point of view. if you go back to the Blair Brown years, David Lammy, seen when he came into Parliament as a rising star, did the speech at the opening of Parliament as a young member of Parliament.
I remember I was a backbencher being very impressed. I was like, who's this new guy?
Exactly. He had taken over Bernie Grant's seat in Tottenham, where he'd grown up in quite a tough environment in poverty. His dad, an alcoholic, got a scholarship to the Cornwall School at Peterborough, ended up through SOAS going to Harvard Law School, where he befriended Barack Obama, a great career which took him into Parliament. But when he got there, to begin with, he didn't deliver that promise. He wasn't put into the cabinet by either Tony Blair or Gordon Brown. Back then, the younger David Lammy, you know, did he have the application? Did he have the judgment? And he had a few kind of media moments which went a bit awry, different things he'd said which didn't quite kind of land properly. A very famous and pretty disastrous appearance on Celebrity Mastermind, which he chose, of course, to go on. His specialist subject was Muhammad Ali. But when it came to the general knowledge section, he didn't do so well. This is one of his most famous answers.
Who acceded to the English throne at the age of 9 on the death of his father, Henry VIII, in 1547?
Henry VII.
Edward VI.
Henry VII did not succeed Henry VIII. It was the other way around, David. But anyway, that was some time ago. And then he's re-emerged in the Keir Starmer period. And I think he's actually done brilliantly well. I mean, he's a rising star. I think he will be the next foreign secretary. And he's been setting the foreign policy agenda for Labour much more than Keir Starmer over the last few months, whether it's in America or in Europe. He's boasting about travelling around the world, bestriding the global stage, talking about his new approach to foreign policy. So, I mean, it's been quite a media campaign and it's been working.
Yeah, I come across him quite a bit, actually, in various sort of foreign policy seminars and think tank events. So he's definitely making an impact. And by the way, the shadow foreign secretary job is quite a hard position to get noticed in because, you know, the nature of foreign affairs is, you know, you often don't say things that are controversial. And if you're in opposition, it's even harder because saying anything controversial can make you look a bit naive or not ready for office or whatever. So I think you're right. And he's having had a kind of meteoric start to his political career, and then it rather sagged through those sort of long years of the Labour government and the Tory governments. He is back right when it matters, which is what politics is all about, timing, isn't it? And we should just sort of say what kind of foreign policy we're likely to see from a Labour government. I mean, will it be very different from what we're getting from David Cameron and Rishi Sunak? The article you mentioned in Foreign Affairs talks about progressive realism. And that's, of course, sort of two, you know, slightly contradictory things. And he uses these two role models in the Labour pantheon. One is Ernest Bevin, not Nye Bevan, who creates the NHS and is the great kind of romantic hero of the left, but actually Ernie Bevin, who's the hard-nosed foreign secretary after the war and helps create NATO, helps commission Britain's nuclear bomb, and is the, you know, definitely from the kind of realpolitik school for Labour, isn't he? And then also then his other choice is Robin Cook, who you and I both know, I'm sure you know much better than me. But as a backbench MP, you know, his resignation speech on the eve of the Iraq war vote was probably about the most memorable thing I saw in all my time as an MP, even more memorable than, you know, in my own mind, than sort of giving budgets and things like that later. This, you know, that speech was electrifying in the House of Commons that night. And, you know, of course, he was sort of known for his promoting an ethical foreign policy, which is why he resigned from the Blair cabinet over Iraq. So it's interesting, isn't it, that Lammy's kind of reaching to those two figures. What do you make of it? You will know more than I do about these strands of Labour Party thinking on foreign affairs.
So he's talking about his approach being an approach which you could call progressive realism. And Ernie Bevin is the realist. He's the one who says, take the world as it is, kind of work with what you've got to pursue our influence, but also to keep us safe. Not the romanticism of the Corbyn years, not hoping the world might be different from how it actually is, not walking away from important relationships, you know, whether it's how you work with Donald Trump or how you work with Saudi Arabia or how you forge a relationship with the Chinese. The realest thing to do is to build alliances and see where you can make progress. But then the progressive part is an Ernie Bevin. That's Robin Cook, who never actually said an ethical foreign policy. He talked about an ethical dimension to foreign policy. And he said a Labour Party should always be seeking, within a realist world, to advance human rights, to stand up for minority or small countries who are being abused by the global system, whether that's Sierra Leone or Kosovo back in that period. And of course, the problem for a Labour Foreign Secretary is when those two things come into conflict. If you take, for example, the discussions which are going on for a trade deal with the Gulf states, you can imagine a progressive realist Labour government saying, we're going to do that trade deal, but seek to bring in some safeguards around workers' rights or around wider human rights issues, if they can find something which is acceptable to say, well, that is the progressive part of our realist policy. You can't imagine the Chinese signing up to that. But on the other hand, David Lammy, a realist foreign secretary, might say that the economic relationship is sufficiently important. If we can influence China to be part of the global community, to cooperate on climate change, it's worthwhile building that relationship, even if we're frustrated by the lack of progress on particular human rights issues. The difficulty is when they become into complete kind of contrast and opposition. With Robin Cook, he got into difficulty when it came to arms sales with Indonesia, completely contradicting protection for the oppressed people in East Timor. Think about right now, the realest thing to do is to support Israel, even while challenging Israel, because they are the bulwark against Iranian aggression. But on the other hand, the people of Gaza, an oppressed minority, the suffering there, you can see the political tension that this is causing Labour in opposition. And a progressive realist approach to the conflict in Israel and Gaza at the moment, I think, would be very uncomfortable for a Labour foreign secretary. So this is not an easy thing to pull off.
Yes, I mean, I think it's going to be fascinating if there's a Labour government to see how it handles foreign policy. You know, David Lammy is trying to sort of stake out a kind of guide to how he will handle things. But the realities when you're in office are quite different. And progressive realism doesn't really mean very much when you're confronted with this basic choice, like, do you do a trade deal with Saudi Arabia? Or in fact, he cites in Foreign Affairs, you know, that moment in 2013 when Ed Miliband voted against missile strikes against Syria when they'd used chemical weapons as a terrible moment. He doesn't mention Ed Miliband, but he says that was a terrible moment for the West and we didn't draw a red line and we should have done it, emboldened Russia. You know, that was David Lammy, Labour MP at the time. So in reality, it's going to be much harder. But I think he gets credit, doesn't he, for doing the most you can do with the shadow foreign secretary job, getting out there, preparing the ground for a potential Trump presidency so it doesn't blindside Labour. It's interesting, of course, you know, Rishi Sunak has taken the unusual position as a prime minister to outsource foreign policy to his foreign secretary. I don't think Keir Starmer is going to do the same. And one thing we might come back to in our kind of ongoing look at Keir Starmer and his upbringing and what informs him is whether the fact he made his career as a human rights lawyer is going to shape his foreign policy. Because if you take a human rights lawyer approach to foreign policy and think it's incredibly important that international law is upheld, then that often leads you to be unrealistic about real world situations and not willing to deal with the world as it is. Now, maybe there are good reasons why you do that because you think that's the only way to make the world a better place. But the collision between Keir Starmer, the human rights lawyer, and David Lammy, you know, sucking up to the Trumpists, is going to be quite an interesting dynamic in a Labour cabinet.
I think that's right. And if I was Keir Starmer and David Lammy, I would be worrying about this now. I would look at the way in which they got into the wrong position on Gaza back in October. And I would worry about what I might be storing up in the way in which they're going about the Trump relationship. And that's not to say that David Lammy is doing the wrong thing. Of course, he's got to build relations. And when he says that Trump is right to challenge Europe on its defence spending, this is not an anti-NATO thing. This is actually asking Europe to pull its weight. That is correct. But there is an asymmetry. I think if you are a conservative prime minister or foreign secretary, it's easier to absorb risk from Donald Trump than it is for Labour in government. And if you think around some of the things which might come up under a Trump presidency, I mean, it could be Gaza, it could be climate change, it could be things which happen within America. If I was then, I'd be putting my defences in place now. Look, the reality is no leader while Trump was the president, was successful in kind of persuading him or tempering him or shaping his view
Lots
of the world.
Lots of people tried. Theresa May tried.
Many
Emmanuel
tried.
Emmanuel Macron tried. They all tried to be the Trump whisperer, didn't they?
They did, and it didn't work. And if you remember that famous moment when Theresa May is meeting Trump and she is in the Rose Garden and she's holding his hand, I think that was the same time as Donald Trump then announces his Muslim travel ban, which smacked of American racism in its approach. I mean, it was quite shocking, but she got away with that. It didn't cause her huge grief on her own side. If it was Keir Starmer walking through the White House Rose Garden, and then without any consultation, Donald Trump said a similar thing, it would cause huge problems for Keir Starmer or for David Lammy. And I think they're leaving themselves quite exposed that if Trump, if he wins and he does things domestically or internationally, which are clearly on the non-progressive side of progressive realism, either at that point you suddenly have to call it out, which looks like a contradiction from the whole approach you've taken for the previous 2 years, or you have to suck it up. And sucking it up politically is suddenly very dangerous, especially for a small minority government with the Greens and the left on the march in Norwich or Bradford or Bristol or Brighton or wherever. And if I was David Lammy...
But equally, by the way, having your Hugh Grant moment and standing up to the United States, normally, you know, it works in a movie, but it doesn't work in the real world where you rely on the United States for all the other foreign policy things you're trying to achieve.
I think that's right. And that is why now you need a bit of kind of balance in your messaging. I know why David Lammy's doing it, and he's been very successful, and he's challenging David Cameron, and he's showing he's a realist on the progressive realist side of things. But I think I would be putting in place my caveats, not least because Trump may lose and Biden may win. And if Biden wins and Britain and a Labour government is then wanting things from a Joe Biden presidency in his second term, people turn around and say, well, where were you guys in the spring of 2024? It's not without risks. I think I would just, you know, I would learn from the Gaza positioning and get my caveats in place. Trump may win and he may do some sensible things in places, but he could also do some very wild and dangerous and destabilising things. Interestingly, this afternoon, according to London Playbook, the London Mayor Sadiq Khan has actually been calling out David Lammy over his efforts to get close to Donald Trump. Sadiq Khan told London Playbook, he said, he's a racist, he's a sexist, he's a homophobe, and it's very important, particularly when you've got a special relationship, that you treat them as a best mate. If my best mate was a racist or a sexist or a homophobe, I'd call him out and I'd explain to him why those views are wrong. So as Playbook say, Lammy has been told.
All very interesting. And you mentioned Gaza. And let's turn finally then to what's happening here on the American campuses, like Stanford, where I'm about to teach a class, where you have these extraordinary encampments that have appeared of students who are protesting at the Israeli actions in Gaza and the lack of an American response to them. And that's coming up next.
So you're out on the west coast of America, Northern California, and this for me is very resonant because I was actually supposed to be born in America. My mum and dad were out in the States in the 60s and I arrived late, missed the cut. Can't be American president, but my parents...
Oh, Ed.
I know.
President Balls. It has a ring to it.
Whether I'd have made it, who knows. But my dad was in Berkeley during the Berkeley riots in 64, 65, and hugely important moment in both my parents' lifetime because, you know, they had to choose politically and they chose. And student riots and protests has been such a big part of American politics over decades, and it's happening again around the Gaza issue, students protesting against their universities accepting money from Israeli donors. And you've been out to see the protesters in Stanford.
Yeah, so on the Stanford campus, there is an encampment of protesters. It's not particularly large or kind of intimidating. It's a bit disappointing when you see it, to be honest, close up. And you can see that the kind of pro-Palestinian cause is entangled with all sorts of other causes on the progressive left, if you can put it like that. So there's a sign at the encampment apologizing to the Native Americans because this encampment is itself on occupied land seized from the Native American tribes hundreds of years ago. So, it's very American, very what they would say here, super woke. And it has been pretty peaceful at Stanford. But in other universities, particularly in Columbia, in the big university in New York, it's got really violent. When the president of Columbia, Manoush Shafiq, who is well known to both of us, she was a permanent secretary in Whitehall, she was a deputy governor of the Bank of England, she was on the board of the British Museum with me. You know, she went out to be president of Columbia, and she is wrestling with these college principals right at the middle of this battle between free speech, you know, allowing protests to take place, but at the same time, the intimidation of Jewish students on the campus, a lot of Jewish donors withdrawing money. I did see at Stanford this slogan, "From the river to the sea," chalked on the wall. And that, you know, if you're Israeli or Jewish, feels like a call to have your homeland exterminated, and with echoes of the Holocaust. So it's really difficult. This was Manoush Shafiq answering questions in Congress about it.
When mobs or people are shouting, "From the river to the sea, Palestine must be free," or "Long live the Infatara," are those anti-Semitic statements? Yes or no? It's not how you feel, it's...
I hear them as such, some people don't. We have sent
so
a clear
yes?
message.
So is that yes?
We have sent a clear message to our community.
I'm not asking about the message. Yeah. Is that fall under definition of anti-Semitic behavior? Yes or no? Why is that so tough?
Because it's a difficult issue because
I realize it's a difficult issue, but here's the problem.
So, you know, Manoush there, I promise you, one of the most sensible and grounded people that I know, was the principal of the London School of Economics, so he's used to dealing with students. You know, really having a tough time here in America at the epicenter of these student protests at Columbia. And what I found in the few days I've been here is that the Israel-Gaza issue is polarizing university campuses and polarizing society much more than it is even in Britain. I know we've had big marches in Britain that Jewish people in Britain feel under threat. But here it's also kind of it's sort of seeped into the political divide. And Joe Biden finds himself right in the middle of this, right? Because he's a Democrat. He's obviously seeking re-election. A lot of the big donors to the Democrat Party are Jewish. They don't think he's being pro-Israeli enough. And yet at the same time, he risks losing Muslim voters who are incredibly important to him. They're vital in the key state of Michigan, which he absolutely needs to win if he's going to stay as president of the United States this autumn. And there are echoes. You were talking about your parents in the 1960s at Berkeley, which is just down the road from here. But there's another great, you know, incredible echo coming up later this year. So in 1968, people might have seen movies about this, the Democrat convention that was in Chicago, and there were riots around the Vietnam War. And we now might have at the Democrat convention in Chicago again this year in 2024, real protests on the left and just presenting to the country a picture of a disunited Democrat Party.
I always think with student protests or with protests like this, you have to ask two questions. One, is the protest succeeding in bringing attention to the subject? And the second thing is, are they succeeding in persuading people to change their minds, to persuade their views? And if you go back to those 60s protests, I mean, absolutely, they brought attention. But also, these were young people who were not only protesting against the war, they were also directly personally affected. They were to be drafted and they were protesting against the draft. They weren't necessarily supporting the other side out in Vietnam, but they were saying, you know, this is not what we want. Don't put us in this position. And I wonder, when you look at what's happening in Stanford or in other US universities, it's clearly getting attention, but is it winning arguments, or is it polarizing?
Well, but Joe Biden has announced, hasn't he, a pause on some arms shipments. And I think he's doing that with one eye on his domestic political problem. A lot of the money for his campaign is going to come from prominent Democrat Jewish supporters who are threatening to withhold it. And without money, you can't run for president. And at the same time, he's got a narrow path to victory, which takes him through the state of Michigan with a significant Muslim population. So there are cities there like Dearborn, where over half the population are Muslim, and they are not going to vote. We had a minor version of it in Britain with the Labour result in the local elections, which was not as good as people expected because Muslim voters felt that Keir Starmer had been too pro-Israel. And Biden finds himself on the horns of a really difficult domestic dilemma, set aside the very real foreign policy dilemma and the incredibly difficult situation in the Middle East, which the United States is asked to broker.
I agree with that. And I think that that is why these protests are having an impact. And they are in Britain as well, for the reasons you say, because people are worried about what Israel is doing in international law terms, but also the huge numbers of deaths of Palestinian people in Gaza. And that's not in any way not to talk about the hostages and the terrible atrocities of 7th of October. But there's no doubt that the protests are drawing attention to the huge numbers of deaths in Gaza. I was just contrasting it in my mind to Just Stop Oil protests, which have been, if not just students, young and old people protesting. And from my point of view, they're very different. Whether you're talking about throwing paint on pictures in the National Gallery or blocking the M25. I mean, there is no doubt those protests raise attention. They get media coverage. But I think, unlike the political pressure being put onto Joe Biden or to Keir Starmer because of Gaza, the climate change protests from Just Stop Oil, I don't think that they do put the same kind of pressure on, because I don't think they persuade people. I don't think the British people look at throwing paint at a picture or the blocking of a motorway and think that has got anything to do with this cause. I think it's alienating.
Well, actually, let me say it. You know, since those protests have been happening, both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party have stepped back from their climate pledges in different ways for different reasons. Labour backed off its £28 billion climate package and the Tories watered down its net zero commitment. So it hasn't galvanised the political parties, those protests. I don't know if it's directly related in any way, but, you know, the man and woman in their 80s who were attacking the Magna Carta the other day, I don't think really are having the effect that they would hope. Anyway, Ed, I was going to ask you a question. When you're Chancellor of Oxford University...
Are you nominating me?
Because there's an election up. There's an election up.
I didn't know I was being nominated.
Yes, you do know there's an election. So you went to Oxford University.
Yeah, but I don't think I'm in this election.
Well, you can be. So the Chancellor of Oxford is an elected post. It's currently Chris Patten. In the past, it's been Roy Jenkins and Harold Macmillan. It often is almost always has been a politician. And there was a wokest attempt to fix the election, to kick the politicians out, to insist on a more diverse array of candidates. Anyway, that has failed, and it's a wide open race for politicians who've, you know, established a bit of a hinterland, who've shown that they're not just, you know, just products of the machine, who, you know, perhaps have featured on some light comedy shows. And I think Ed Balls for Chancellor, you know, not the Chancellor job you wanted, but a pretty good one nonetheless. Why not? Then you can handle these encampments at Oxford.
Because I've got a proper job. In fact, you know, I've not got as many...
I'm not sure it is a proper job, this
exactly.
One, so you could do it as well.
I mean, you know, but I've not got as many jobs as you, but I've got enough to keep me busy. So,
you could be Chancellor of Oxford. You'd be great. You'd get my vote.
Yeah, I think...
Anyway, we've got to stop Rory Stewart, the rival podcaster.
The problem is, I think I would just end up saying the wrong things. One of the things I sort of feel at the moment... There's this whole discussion amongst young people saying that we must kind of understand their sensitivity, that they shouldn't be put in difficult positions, that we shouldn't raise issues which are upsetting. And whether you're talking about kind of power or misogyny or kind of wider issues. But when it comes to protesting about what's happening in Gaza and then chanting from the river to the sea, what about the feelings of Jewish students in those universities? I mean, why isn't that important too? And I'm afraid if I was running for Chancellor of the University, I would have to point to that fundamental inconsistency and say, if we need to be sensitive to your concerns, you've got to be sensitive to the concerns and fears and worries of others. And if you chant and demonstrate in a way which makes other people feel afraid, then we should care about that too. And that might end up losing me the election.
Look, you know, due to your careless parents, you can't be president, Balls. And due to the British electorate, you weren't chancellor.
I wasn't sure who you were going to blame there. I was waiting to find out who you were blaming.
Now, I could see Chancellor Balls of Oxford University. I think we launched the election campaign right here, right now.
I know. Well, the candidate's got to be willing to stand.
Well, you can be dragged to it like the Speaker in the House goes. Anyway,
goodness, we've run out of time. We've very much enjoyed your dispatches from San Francisco.
Well, it's been great here, but I'm also looking forward to getting back home.
And, you know, by the time this podcast drops, we will know whether Norwich are in the playoff final or not. But for now, wish me luck.
I do, of course. May the best side win.
Well, I know that might be the problem. Anyway, we love getting your questions and your comments and your reviews. And so do send us in your feedback and your questions to questions@politicalcurrency.co.uk.
Yes, and do sign up to our own convention. That's you can become part of the team of Political Currency Gold, where you get ad-free membership and you get early sight of EMQ's ex-minister's questions. And you can find details of how to subscribe in the show notes.
And we'll be back on Monday answering your questions in EMQ. See you then.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to Political Currency. This has been a Persephonica production.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I am Dori Shafrir, the co-host of the podcast Forever 35, which is all about the things we do to take care of ourselves. And starting next week, we have a new co-host.
It's me. I'm Elise Hugh. I am an author, journalist, and a podcaster.
Yay! Elise and I are going to be getting into a lot of the same topics that we've always talked about on Forever 35, like skincare, like getting older, and of course, Forever 35 faves like butt care and Costco.
She said Costco.
I said it.
I'm so excited to be coming along on this journey.
I am so excited to have you. So listen to Forever 35 wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.